From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, 1 year after Beyoncé, what does Coachella have in store? Then two segments on how music helps navigate life's challenges. First, how the song Quiet, performed at the 2017 Women's March, became a ballad for female empowerment.
The song comes from a place of feeling unheard and unsafe in my own home, my own body. And I think people felt unsafe in their own country, in their cities at that point.
And two trans musicians from a small town write the kind of hip-hop they wanted to hear growing up. All that on The Frame.
Podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Dogman, from the director of Gomorra, is a crime thriller that tells a story of vengeance where only the strong survive. Best Actor winner at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival. Opens April 12th in New York and L.A.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. It's pre-Coachella week. The biggest music festival in the world kicks off this weekend with headliners Ariana Grande, Childish Gambino, and Tame Impala. But the internet is buzzing anew over last year's legendary performance by Beyoncé, the story of which is now going to be told in a new Netflix documentary that drops on April 17th. Michael Wood is the pop music critic for the LA Times, and he was at that show.
She brought somewhere around 100, maybe over 100 musicians and dancers. The show was styled sort of to resemble, say, a halftime performance at a game at a historically black college or university. And the entire show kind of functioned as a tribute to that artistic, creative tradition. It was new songs. It was old songs, radically reimagined. It was just one of the most comprehensive productions I've seen anywhere. But it was especially striking at Coachella, which is, you know, artists call it throw and go, where you just show up and you have to put up a kind of simplified version of your setup because, you know, someone just played before you, someone's just playing after you. And Beyoncé just sort of like completely disregarded that. She made everything her own and she completely owned the space.
What does it do for other artists when there's an event so recent in the past that was so good? Do they try to top it, or do they just know that they can't really beat Beyoncé at her own game?
I think everybody in pop probably knows there's no beating Beyoncé. She's just on a different level. That said, it definitely raises the temperature. It says to people, okay, you really need to bring something memorable. And I also think it's great for Coachella because Beyoncé's performance shows us that Coachella is a place that wants to host these memorable performances, which of course attracts more people that do memorable performances, which then, you know, it's a loop. So I think the year after Beyoncé, you know, 1AB, is going to be a year when people really feel like they need to bring something that's not your typical performance because that's so fresh in our memory. I mean, you got to live up to that as much as you can.
I know the headliners probably like to keep a lot of what they're going to do secret, but has anything leaked out about what might be up for the headliners, Childish Gambino, Tame Impala, and Ariana Grande?
Things are starting to slip out. So Childish Gambino has what's been described as a movie, a film coming with Rihanna called Guava Island. And little social media branding blips are starting to show up on Spotify and elsewhere.
Practice is perfection.
I can do it when no one is listening.
And Childish Gambino, as your listeners probably know, is Donald Glover, the actor. I suspect this performance will have something to do with this new project that he's got.
And then I see on the lineup something called Sunday Service, not this coming Sunday, but on Easter, which is 2 weeks out. What do we know about Sunday Service on Easter at Coachella?
So that is a Kanye West extravaganza. Kanye was reported to be in the running to headline Coachella this year. Then the organizer of Coachella, Paul Tolet with Golden Voice, told us that they couldn't come to an agreement on the staging. Kanye wanted to do something that was not on the typical Coachella stage, and Coachella couldn't go along with that. But they're having him come back for this Sunday Service, which is a series he's been doing around L.A. where he does these sort of Sunday morning gospel church-like experiences with music and guest singers and various rando celebrities who show up. And he's doing a version of that at Coachella. There's word that they're building some sort of situation on the Coachella campgrounds. They're putting something up on a mountain. I mean, who knows? With Kanye, you just never know what this thing is going to be. But, I mean, I'm excited to see that for sure.
Ariana Grande is one of the headliners. And then high up on certain days are Janelle Monáe, Blackpink, Billie Eilish, Churches. Would you say that the festival has done a pretty good job in terms of programming acts led by women, or do they still have room to go?
This is the best that you could almost imagine, which leaves room for improvement, because that's just the sort of way that the world of live music is right now. But I think this lineup overall does a really good job of sort of capturing where pop is right now. And it doesn't feel, you know, Coachella loves to use this word curated, but to me, curated always gives me a little bit of a gross feeling, because there's something overly strategic about it. This lineup, it was clear that it was put together that way. But when you look at it, you're like, yeah, if you follow pop music, this makes sense. As for women, I mean, anyone who follows pop will tell you that those are the most impactful artists for the past few years. So, of course, they should be represented in the way they are. But that also goes for a lot of the Latin pop acts. That goes for Blackpink, the K-pop group, which is exciting to see at Coachella.
Let me ask you this last question. On Saturday morning, a veteran stagehand at Coachella died when he apparently fell 60 feet from scaffolding working on a stage. How important is safety to Coachella, not just for the people who are working there, but for the people who are attending Coachella?
It's super important. Last year, there was a really widely read piece that Teen Vogue did about sexual harassment at Coachella, which is, I mean, that's a nightmare for Golden Voice. They don't want to be seen as a festival where you, as an audience member, you don't feel safe. So I think they've been super careful about trying to solve the problem, of course, but also trying to fix the PR problem. Golden Voice is rolling out this program called Everyone, which, and they have to have a code of conduct, which I guess they're going to be sort of harder on certain kinds of behavior, maybe kicking people out. I don't know. We're going to see. But I think that they're paying more attention to it, and they're clearly wanting people to feel like they can report instances of whatever might happen.
Michael Wood is the pop music critic for the LA Times. Michael, I don't need to tell you this, but stay hydrated, wear sunscreen, and take your earplugs.
I will do my best, John. Thank you.
Coming up, the LA-based singer-songwriter who goes by Milk had a viral hit with her song Quiet. Now she's keeping the momentum going. On January 21st, 2017, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, thousands of women in cities across the U.S. and around the world marched in protest. For the L.A.-based singer-songwriter who goes by the name Milk, it was a life-changing day. She marched in Washington, D.C. and performed her song Quiet with a small group of singers that she'd recruited ahead of time.
I can't keep crying.
Filmmaker Alma Harrell recorded a cell phone video of one of their performances of Quiet, and it quickly spread online. Soon, women around the world were singing and sharing their versions of the song, along with stories of what Quiet meant to them. As a way to keep that sense of community going, Milk started I Can't Keep Quiet Day. In 2017, there were flash mob performances. In 2018, it was a concert. And this year, today, it's an online storytelling project at icantkeepquiet.org. When I spoke with Milk recently, she explained what it was like when her song Quiet first started getting attention online.
It was such a special moment. I didn't quite realize it was happening because, you know, it was in real time. It wasn't until 7 hours after the march where I started getting texts from friends all over the world saying, like, Emma Watson retweeted your performance. I had no idea what they were talking about. I was like, I haven't even edited the video to post it, you know. And Alma Harrell, like, she was lost, actually, during the march. And then our singing group, we got stuck at an intersection, and this was the last time we were going to sing. Our plan was to go to the side of the stage and sing there and meet a couple of friends. That was the original plan, but our singing group got stuck, and then Alma was lost, and she happened to intersect with us. And that was our last performance, and she captured it on her phone, and it just felt a little bit like destiny. You know, I look back at that day, and I think about all the self-doubt I had leading up to that moment. Like, what am I doing? You know, I'm bringing this song across the country and singing it on the streets. My management just dropped me, and I don't know where I'm going after I get back to LA. And I had a moment of wisdom with myself. I think we all have this sometimes. We have this like wiser voice in us, and if we listen to it, it gets louder. But that was one of the moments where I listened to that wiser voice, and she was like, you have done everything that you have felt feels right about this song. Because I just felt this odd drive to just make this idea happen, and nothing else mattered. Like, I didn't really shower. I was just not sleeping. I was just like really set on this idea. And I kind of, before the song went viral, I talked to myself during the march, and I was like, you know what, Connie, like, it's going to be what it is going to be. Whoever's going to hear the song is going to hear it. And if it's meant to be shared, it will. And you've done everything you can. And so be kind with yourself and just like enjoy the march. And then lo and behold, it was like I was holding this crystal at the right place, you know, and then the light was shining through and a rainbow just kind of ricocheted from that crystal that I was holding. It was just like right time and right place, you know. But I do feel like my whole life led up to that moment.
One of the things that strikes me about watching this performance is not only are the women singing beautifully, but they're singing as if this story is their story. And I'm wondering if you think that that's part of why this song struck a chord with people, that it became something that they could talk about what they went through, what they were feeling, that maybe they had a hard time putting into words of their own.
When I write lyrics, I like to be right at that point in the Venn diagram, that intersection of my truth and an openness for other people to be able to take this song to make their own. When I write in the songwriting rooms, I'm always thinking like, is this going to create value for someone else's life and mine? And I was thinking about why this song started becoming so important to people. My best theory so far is that, you know, I didn't quite feel safe or heard in my own home sometimes, not because of lack of love, just, you know, traditional versus like modern cultural barriers. And also, I didn't feel quite safe with myself because of the blame that I put on myself for being sexually assaulted. And I didn't trust myself anymore.
Put on your face, know your place. Shut up and smile, don't spread your legs.
And so the song comes from a place of feeling unheard and unsafe in my own home, my own body. And I think people felt unsafe in their own country, in their cities, in their communities at that point. Like some people did, right? Not everyone. But I feel like the messages that I was getting from people from all over the U.S., but also Australia and Sweden and different countries and Ghana, people were just like, we're not being heard and we're not safe here as well. And they would share with me what's going on with the politics of their countries as well. And it just felt oddly parallel. And everyone's kind of going through a very similar theme of needing to reclaim their homes. And for me, reclaiming my body and also trust for self. So I think that's what was happening on a macro level as well.
And is that why it's important to you, and I think people who care about this issue, that it doesn't stop, that you now have I Can't Keep Quiet Day, which is April 8th, to make sure that every year you remember what these issues are, what changes are coming about, and to actually solicit stories? I think you're doing this now as sort of some online collaboration where people are sharing things that have happened to them and their responses to similar issues.
I think it's really important to continue this dialogue. And even, you know, even as the Me Too movement and all these things, like, I can't tell the future if it's going to be a main topic of discussion in the media. But, you know, for me, I've made a promise to myself that, like, I want to be a social change artist and be proactive rather than reactive. I want to create a safe space for people to share their stories, learn to be vulnerable, learn that other people will listen and trust them. And then also on the other end is to create a platform where people can amplify stories through art. You know, I want to create, and it's forming now, which is a really cool thing, is just a community of gentle rebels, is what I call them, who are using collaborative energy and artistic energy to help each other rise above oppressive silences. Because I think that peace comes from storytelling, and it comes from art and expression, and, you know, it comes from many, many things, but I know collaboration and art the best, so I am going to focus on that. And I think I'm, you know, I feel really clear about that. You know, when the song Quiet went viral, I was like, you know, I'm new to all of this and I don't know what my mission is, but, you know, 2 years later, I'm like, I'm so clear that this is why I was put on earth, is to create space for people to collaborate, be expressive. And I hope that that healing process through the icantkeepquiet.org, if people go there and they want to be a part of this project, I hope that it heals them and empowers them so that they can go into their own communities and spread this sense of, like, ease and calm and peacefulness, and perhaps less of this, like, hatred and fear will be ricocheting everywhere.
It's clear that your song has meant a lot to a lot of other people. I'm going to ask you about what somebody else's song has meant to you. This is a 1970 song created by a band that not a lot of people have heard of, called the Five Stair Steps. On your album from 2018, This Is Not the End, you do a cover of it. It's one of my favorite songs. It's called Ooh Child. Let's listen to a little bit of it.
Someday we'll walk in the rays of a beautiful sun. Someday when the world is much brighter. Things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter.
What does a song like that mean to you, and why is it important that you share it with your audience?
Ooh, Child is such a timeless, classic song. Not only musically is it really interesting, like, it goes from major to minor seamlessly. The chords are unexpected, and also the lyrics are effortlessly simple but so powerful, and I aspire to write songs like that. So on a nerd, you know, songwriter standpoint, I just am such a fan of how that song was written. But on a, you know, social and artist macro level, this song is transforming in meaning, because, I mean, for me personally, I look at the movements that are coming from the youth right now, from March for Our Lives to, you know, the climate strikes that happen. I'm seeing the kids kind of moving forward to demand for a better world. And so this song has taken on a more intricate meaning. On one side, you know, as a woman in her 30s, I'm like, things will get easier, but also at the same time when I'm singing this, I'm also reminding myself I have to do a lot of work to help ensure that these kids will have a space to live on this planet. And this year when I've been touring the song, I've been kind of telling the audiences how this song has kind of shifted for me a little bit, because the children are rising and setting an amazing example for us adults.
Milk, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.
You can find out more about Milk's initiative at icantkeepquiet.org. Coming up on The Frame, the indie hip-hop artists who are writing music for marginalized communities.
Been so accommodating to your manipulating. Oh.
KPCC podcast supported by Cinema Made in Italy and Magnolia Pictures. Presenting Dogman, a sly crime thriller from the award-winning director of Gomorrah, winner of the Best Actor Award at the 2018 Cannes Film Festival and the European Film Awards. Dogman tells a story of vengeance where only the strong will survive. Official selection of the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals and the winner of 9 Italian Oscars, including Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, and Actor. Opens Friday, April 12th in New York and Los Angeles.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Close Good is an indie hip-hop duo composed of musicians Knife and Amata. The two began making music almost as soon as they met. The 22-year-olds, who are both trans, were students together at a small community college in a rural Northern California town where, as you might imagine, the LGBTQ culture wasn't exactly thriving. But since moving away from Napa County, they've quickly made a name for themselves in L.A.'s underground hip-hop community. Their debut album, Graven, was produced by Anthony Kilhoffer, a Grammy-winning producer who has worked with Kanye West and Travis Scott. They stopped by The Frame Studios and spoke with our producer, Jonathan Shiflett.
Hi, my name's Knife, and I'm one half of Close Good.
I'm Amata, and I'm the other half of Close Good.
It's actually kind of funny. Me and Amata went to the same college, so it was kind of like us meeting through mutual friends. There was a lot of events where we were in the same room, but we didn't really like talk to each other or know each other like that. But then we found ourselves like at that college campus over the summer, and it was pretty desolate, and it's a very small college town. There was like nobody there. So we kind of started hanging out with each other out of necessity.
We were so depressed.
There's no other people in the city.
There's nothing to do here. There's nobody our age. There's not even food that we can go to.
Yeah, there wasn't really that much like art culture either, so we decided we had to kind of make it for ourselves.
While we were up there, I was studying to be a film major, and I had keys to the sound studio that no one ever used. And it had a bunch of equipment and a computer, and we just ended up working there after a little while.
Yeah. We were kind of just making music for fun, just to pass the time, and then we were like, if we have access to this equipment, we might as well like teach ourselves something and like try it out. So.
And we really started throwing ourselves into it there, yeah.
Yeah.
Or that first summer was us alternating, like one of us would sleep on the floor, one of us would sleep on the couch, and then the next night.
Yeah. So I think we were kind of looking out for each other as a family unit, like pretty early on into our music making process, just like making sure we were both good.
I'm not light enough for your party. I'm not cool enough for your friends. I drink rum in the shower every morning, and I always cancel all my plans. I'm not close enough to your idea of who I really am.
I got into hip hop kind of early just because that was like the place where I could see the most like black experience reflected, which was like really important to me as a kid because I felt like I just didn't really have the connection with my blackness that I wanted to when I was younger, just based off like environment and stuff. But even amongst that, like I didn't find that many like femme voices and that many queer voices and trans voices in the way that I wanted. So I think like that was a little difficult in terms of feeling represented. But also when I started listening to like music that was based more on mental health and kind of like your typical sad music, like your indie boy sad music, like when I found that, I felt a little bit represented on the like mental health and emotional spectrum, but I wanted those two worlds to come together in a way that wasn't really happening for me. So that's why I was like, I guess gotta make it if I want it to be actually accurate.
When I think about the past, it's a blurry mess. In the future's in the bag, I could worry less. Don't you worry just yet, you can't advance unless you plant your stance and count your blessings.
Like, for example, in my verse at the beginning of that song, I'm talking about, like, dealing with mental illness and dealing with transness and not necessarily, like, remembering my childhood the best. It's, like, all foggy. It was all just kind of, like, me addressing, okay, this is me in the past, this is me right now, and then I don't know what's happening next. And
yeah, it's like
music.
You get older, but you don't necessarily get less fearful of mm-hmm. things. You can still feel like a kid, even though you're like talking about not being a kid anymore. So
I don't know. It feels like our music is very much like a point on a timeline, and then it goes out both directions. And it's like the song is like the here and now, and then the content is like forward and backward.
I swear I will be worthy of you wanting me.
Easy as a song for me is about just the people in my life that I care about and the people that I feel like I need to articulate to on a more like frequent basis that they are not difficult to love and that my love for them isn't some sort of burden or isn't work, but is something that I can enjoy and something that they shouldn't feel insecure about, because I think like anytime you love someone, it can be really effortless.
I remember us making the song like before there was even really lyrics on it and just enjoying how like happy it was, and you definitely put that into the song. You brought that same level of like happiness and love.
You are so easy to love. You are so easy to love. Yeah.
I personally feel like I'm making music for people who wanted to hear songs like this when they were growing up, which is like about blackness, about queerness, about like depression and mental health, but like not necessarily in a way where you can't still find joy.
Yeah, I don't know if I could give a better answer than that, but I'm personally making music for other sad, lonely trans kids.
Yep.
And people that are just having a really hard time.
And also that like you can find community, and like community makes those things good. Mm-hmm. Even when you're like struggling, that there's people out there that are like you, that are like struggling in the same ways that you're struggling. And if like I could find someone to be quite honestly like a partner to me in my life and in my music in Anguin, which is the smallest place ever where I didn't think I was going to find other like-minded people, then like you can find that in your city or your suburbs.
Out in the woods, little green boy swallows blue.
That was the hip-hop duo Close Good. Their debut album, Graven, is out now. That's all we have for today. Later this week, Bryan Cranston stops by to talk about playing Howard Beale in the stage version of Network, and comedian Rami Youssef on his new Hulu series. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.
Be gone. Be gone, be gone, be gone.